This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Our first story today deals with a history of child abuse allegations at a former Vermont orphanage and may be disturbing to some listeners. This segment is about 20 minutes long. There's a building on Burlington's North Avenue that's been in the headlines a fair amount over the years. It was at the center of the land deal that eventually sunk Burlington College. Now it's a block of apartments. But before these changes, for more than 100 years until the 1970s, it was a Catholic orphanage called St. Joseph's. A new investigative report from BuzzFeed News looks at the history of St. Joseph's, and it assembles staggering accounts of abuse at the facility, including emotional and physical abuse, sexual assault and rape, and possibly the killing of children. The article is titled, "We Saw Nuns Kill Children, The Ghosts of St. Joseph's Catholic Orphanage." The author of the report is Christine Keneally, senior investigations contributor for BuzzFeed News. She's based in Melbourne, Australia, and I spoke with her there yesterday about what she found. She offered a brief history of the orphanage.
Yes, St. Joseph's Orphanage was founded in 1854 in Burlington, Vermont, and it was run by an order of nuns known as the Sisters of Providence. And in fact, they had come from Montreal, from Quebec, to set up this orphanage in Burlington. And at the time of the orphanage's operation, which was for over a century, it closed around 1974. For most of its running, there were maybe 20 or 30 nuns who were there at the orphanage, and anywhere up to, at times, 350 children. So the children were mostly from that local area. Of course, it was known as an orphanage, but like most orphanages actually across the United States, many of the kids weren't orphans at all. They were the children of poverty, of incredibly poor families, of misfortune, parents who were alcoholic or addicted, and in some cases, you know, children who were taken away by the state because their families were not looking after them properly at all. So for much of its operation, the orphanage was pretty opaque to the rest of the world. And what coverage there was, what stories there were about it, were stories of benevolence and charity and of self-sacrificing nuns looking after children. In actual fact, the experience of most of the children inside that place was very, very different. In the 1990s, there was litigation. More than 100 people came forward to describe terrible abuse that they'd suffered over decades at the orphanage.
And that's where your investigative report picks up the story, is with these stories, these detailed reports, these personal accounts of really horrific abuse at this orphanage. Can you tell us one story that has really just stayed in your heart and mind?
Oh, that is a great question. And, you know, it's actually really hard to answer because there was so much abuse, and there are so many stories that have stayed with me. And I have to say, as long as the BuzzFeed News article is, it's truly just a small sampling of the incidents that I read about at St. Joseph's, let alone incidents from across the United States. But I think one story that I will certainly never forget started to come to light in the 1990s when the plaintiff's lawyer, Bob Widman, was hearing from different women who were coming forward who'd been at the orphanage. And these women, many of whom had not seen each other since their days at the orphanage, certainly didn't even know each other at the time, told Bob Widman about an event where a young girl was punished for stealing a piece of candy from a nun. And the punishment consisted of getting all the girls into a room, having the girls stand in front of them, and the nun, and I believe another nun who held her hand, pulled out a box of matches and burnt her hand to teach her not to steal again. It was just incredible going through the depositions from the litigation and just reading version after version of this same story. And Bob Widman had a similar experience in the 1990s, and he told me one day that he got a phone call. He'd been searching desperately for the woman who was actually burned, but he couldn't find her. And one day he got a phone call and he picked up the phone and the woman said, "You know, I heard you're looking for the girl whose hand was burned." And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, that was me." And she told him effectively the same story that everyone else had. And that story had haunted all of these women for their entire lives.
It's an amazing story, not just because of the the abuse and the just meanness of it, but also because, as you detail in your writing, each person who witnessed this had a slightly different version. And of course, that's how we now know victims of abuse often remember the abuse. Like most memories, it can be a little bit inaccurate, but there's a through line that you found and that investigators during the 90s who were looking at this in a legal case found for incidents that happened that many people remembered. And there was certainly a line of truth through them that everybody remembered.
That's absolutely right. And that's what was incredible about going through these materials from the deposition. And then also, of course, talking to people 20 years later. Sometimes the details differed with these stories, but the core was always the same, and it was really strong. These were reliable witnesses. And it was really interesting in the 1990s because the question of memory became a bone of contention in this really combative litigation. And, you know, much was made of it. But it's actually not so complicated that, you know, that we can't make sense out of it, that it doesn't make sense now to us. We obviously know a lot more now than we did back then about trauma and about memory and about childhood abuse. So, you know, there were inconsistencies in some of the depositions. People sometimes got names wrong, or they'd forgotten that they'd previously remembered something. But really, most of those inconsistencies were quite small. And certainly, as expert witnesses pointed out at the time, you know, with all kinds of memory, including traumatic memory, you would generally expect some kind of inconsistency. If I think one of them actually pointed out, one of the expert witnesses said, you know, if someone's memory is 100% on every single time, that's when you'd actually start to worry. But certainly with traumatic memory, you know, it's different sometimes for different people. So some former residents of the orphanage never forgot what happened to them. It stayed with them and it stayed in their consciousness always. Other people didn't remember. They pushed it away as much as they possibly could, or they experienced it as a kind of amnesia. Like, they simply had no sense of what had happened to them. And some of them remembered small pieces, but that was like, it was like small pieces of a puzzle. And they were never, as adults, able to really put that puzzle together, to just have a sense of the whole picture and to understand how it had actually shaped them in their lives. So for those people, you know, they sometimes had that experience, which I think, again, we would all now recognize because of what we know, because of popular culture, as a kind of a classic experience of being triggered, of walking down the street, of seeing a nun, of hearing someone else's story, and then suddenly experiencing just a rush of memories flooding them. It's a very distressing experience for a lot of people. And in that way, suddenly accessing again all this knowledge about what had happened to them all that time ago.
Christine, you gave us an example of one of the types of abuse that's alleged to have happened at St. Joseph's Catholic Orphanage. But can you back out and give us sort of the scope of the abuse, the scope of what people say happened there and who was doing it, who was perpetrating it?
Yes. The stories of abuse were extensive and detailed and astonishingly wide. There was sexual abuse at the orphanage perpetrated by men and by women. There was very cruel emotional abuse. And I really want to underline that for a lot of these people, both at St. Joseph's and other former residents of orphanages I've spoken to, sometimes the emotional abuse is just as bad as any other kind of abuse. That's what really stays with a lot of people their whole lives and haunts them. And there was physical abuse up to and including what you can call nothing else but torture. Children were hung upside down over stair rails and outside windows. They had water streamed into their faces. They were held underwater. As I told you before, they were burned. And there was just horrible, horrible violence. Children were punched in the face. They were whipped by just out of control, unhinged adults. The physical abuse also involved allegations of death and allegations of murder. There were eyewitness accounts of a boy being pushed out of a boat and then never surfacing again, a young boy being thrown out of a fourth-story window. One man told a story about finding the body of a child frozen, tied to a tree on a late winter's night. there was another child who drowned. That story actually hit the pages, the front pages at the time. People know about that one. The official story was that he was swimming and he drowned, but there are eyewitness accounts from other children who said that he was pushed off a raft by other children. There was a story, an eyewitness account of a baby being smothered, and there were numerous stories about children just being beaten so horribly that the witnesses never forgot it, but that the child who was beaten was never seen again after that day.
As I was going through your reporting on this, I kept wondering why. And you know, obviously you don't have an answer either, and nor do the victims. And there's not a lot of admission of guilt from any nuns or other people who were involved who are still alive. So do you have any sense of why there was such widespread abuse? What would compel adults to systematically treat children this way for so many years and for other people to clearly turn a blind eye?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And I searched for an answer to that question. And I can tell you about the things that I found, none of which are complete. And one is, you know, if you look at the women who were running the place, the women who were part of this order of nuns, a lot of them were from the same communities that the residents of the orphanage were from. A lot of them joined the order that they were in at a very young age, some as young as 14, others 18 or 20. They were themselves from poverty-stricken families, and they become part of this order at a very young age. So when there's a culture of dehumanizing children, of treating them in different ways, I think it's reasonable to ask about the ways in which these young nuns were indoctrinated into that from a fairly early age. In addition to which, the institution itself, as I said, was quite opaque. There wasn't really any oversight at all. There was very little transparency. And of course, using a word like transparency is kind of, doesn't really historically make sense. You wouldn't have expected there to be that. But there certainly wasn't oversight, where there weren't independent bodies checking regularly and thoroughly, most importantly, on this place. I think with institutions like this, from the children that I've spoken to, you know, from orphanages all over the world, many of them have told me about the one nice person, how there was one lovely nun, or there was a good priest, or a really helpful person who worked in the kitchen. And so often they said to me, that person left soon, that the nice people don't last long, whether they're drummed out, whether they actually tried to report and were sent away, it's not clear to me, but the good people didn't last long is a very consistent message. And then I think ultimately it becomes clear that these places are perfect for predators, because there's a culture of secrecy, because no one's going to report you if you do something terrible. So why wouldn't you target a place like that to work?
We're calling you right now from your base in Melbourne, Australia. People will be able to hear your accent as well. How did you come to rest on an orphanage from the past in Burlington, Vermont, to be the real focus of years of research? You were also looking at other orphanages in other places, including other United States locations. But how did you find and settle on Burlington?
Well, I had been talking to former residents of orphanages in other countries before this, people in Australia, people in the UK, people in Ireland, and I wanted to know about the American story, and that's why I started looking in America to begin with. I wanted to understand the history of orphanages in America. I knew there had to be one, but it was very strangely hard to find at the beginning. So I spent a long time just looking for those American stories. And I started talking to attorneys who had been involved in cases of child sexual abuse by priests and psychologists. And they started to mention to me, just a few of them separately described this terrible place that they'd heard of where these awful things have happened. And that was St. Joseph's in Burlington, Vermont. So I started looking into that. And then the other extraordinary thing about the St. Joseph's story is that there was this litigation in the 1990s. So as disappointing and distressing as that experience was for the people who came forward and gave depositions, what their courage at that time meant was that a huge amount of material was generated during that process. So I was able to get hold of all of these statements that were taken under oath, not just by the former residents of the orphanage, but by some nuns who had worked there and by priests who had worked there as well. So it was possible to take all that material, to sit down and to start cross-referencing those stories and to really to witness the enormous amount of corroboration that there was during the litigation.
You mentioned that the stress and anxiety that being involved in this kind of litigation would present for a victim, but you also say disappointment, and that's because for most of these victims, they may have received a small settlement, but nobody saw a perpetrator of abuse jailed or convicted or, you know, sort of put to justice.
That's right. And that there were small settlements that were made upon them in the 90s, but they were really small and almost nothing else was done. But I think one thing that's come out of this investigation and essentially this review of what has happened is that it's really clear that it's not too late. It's unclear what exactly can and should happen, but there can still be a serious investigation by law enforcement. You know, so much is obvious now from the record. It's possible to still put these stories together. It's undeniable when you look at the kind of corroboration. And I think the general culture, of course, has changed completely since the 1990s. So an investigation now would take place in a context where people are actually informed about what went inside these institutions, where people understand that not only is it possible that a priest or any member of the clergy might abuse a child, but that it happened across the country time and time again. And critically, that so often when it happened, it was accompanied by these really well-organized cover-ups as well. Going into an investigation with that in mind, I think would make an enormous amount of difference to the kind of result that the residents would get.
Is that what you hope happens, that there's sort of that there's a deeper law enforcement and legal investigation into St. Joseph's?
Yes, absolutely. I think that needs to happen. I think that the evidence is there, the materials are there, and this story obviously is crying out for that kind of justice and attention. But also, what I was so keen to see happen, and what has really already started to happen because the response to this story has been extraordinary, is just that these former residents of the orphanage are heard and heard properly and heard across the country. And that's already started to happen. I mean, they never got that kind of justice. They were never believed. And it's time that happened. And it's time this story took its place in American history, which it has not before now.
Do you see signs that reforms, that backstops, that systems are in place to make sure this isn't still happening or couldn't happen again?
Certainly a lot has changed. And as I said, the beliefs that we have about what can happen, whether a member of the clergy might even abuse a child, have changed completely. So that's really, really critical. Obviously, there are systems in place where there's generally more oversight and more transparency into institutions or organizations or systems that are somehow looking after children. I worry that because this story was never told properly, that we haven't even had a chance to learn the lessons, though, of the orphans of America. I think we really need to understand how bad things were before we can be absolutely positive that we're going to make sure they don't happen again.
A lot of your research was using these documents, as you've pointed out, from this litigation in the 1990s. But you also found documents that weren't given to the lawyers in that case at the time. And you've talked with victims over the years. How have you advanced what was already known about this story, in addition to sort of bringing it to light, making sure that it's out in the open more?
Yeah, I was able to get hold of rather huge amount of documentation that casts really a completely different light on what happened in the 1990s. Although there were so many stories told, so many people came forward, and really incredibly important and vital reporting was done by the local press, particularly the Burlington Free Press. what I was able to find were documents that show, for, among other things, just by way of one example, that a number of priests who took the stand, who gave depositions about the orphanage in the 1990s, and who expressed incredible shock at the accusations and disgust even that someone might suggest they or another priest or a nun could do something that horrible, were in fact themselves predators.
When I listened to your story, there's somebody else narrated it, but it was all of the text of your work. I had to leave the office because it was so difficult to listen to. I didn't think that I could keep my face in a professional expression in the office while just listening to story after story of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. I can't fathom how you spent 4 years listening to people tell these stories and living with these stories and living with this work. How did you do that for 4 years?
It was extraordinary. It's been really intense and at times incredibly harrowing. And I have learned lessons, much like you just described, for example, as I was reading through account after account after account, realizing that when I started to actually feel physically sick, I needed to walk away and go for a walk and catch my breath and just process it a little. But then, you know, once I had done that, to go back and to keep reading, I've never stopped being shocked. I am still shocked by how profoundly unheard these people have been and by how desperately the need to be heard, you know, must be met. But, you know, I took inspiration from the people I met. The lessons in endurance and courage were incredible. What these people went through and the fact that they were still willing to take another chance to tell a story. And in almost every case, not just to have their story heard, just the really desperate, passionate need most of them feel that the stories must be heard because they need to make a difference, because they don't want to see this happen again, was really incredible.
Christine Keneally is a Melbourne, Australia-based journalist and a senior investigations contributor to BuzzFeed News. Her new piece is called We Saw Nuns Kill Children, The Ghosts of St. Joseph's Catholic Orphanage, and we have a link on our webpage at vpr.net. Christine, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Jane.